I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 36, and I also want to announce that we will continue to carry over 570 and 571. We're not going to do anything with those today, at least not here in this committee.
You do have a couple of sign-ups.
Mr. Chair, does that mean I can cancel all those meetings I have?
Yeah.
Do you want to hear that? No.
All those nice people that had to get up early.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, Senate Bill 36 is kind of an annual phenomenon, and it is a reviser's bill. And this is where they go through and look at different Oregon tax statutes. And in places, language would need to be modernized, so they make changes. And also there's a lot of outdated statutes that the measure will eliminate the references to them. There may be a slight change that will be needed. There could be an amendment coming up because it repeals a pollution control tax credit in 315.304. However, this has sunset in 2007, but there are still recipients because they were qualified for 10 years at that time. So there'll be recipients up to 2017 and then a 3-year extension to 2020. It will require probably an amendment to remove that reference, but the rest of the measure just modernizes language.
Okay, Christine, could you put this in context to us of what we're talking about here in terms of what we're cleaning up, what's going away, and
sure. So there is an outdated statute, including a pre-2004 limit on land that can be designated as tax-exempt riparian land, and that is expired at this point, so the reference to it is changed. Kate Toswell from Legislative Council is also here today. She's available to explain some of these in further detail.
My, oh my, it's quiet in here once stop talking about our favorite subject.
I'm looking forward to Valentine's Day. I just want you to know that.
Yeah. Kate, you want to come
That's
up?
That's holiday of the year.
I know we're talking about largely
That's the deadline
technical
of do nothing to throw it up in the bus.
Changes here. And I know that much of this has to do with what we used to call the pollution control tax credit.
Good morning, Chair Hess, members of the committee. I'm Kate Toswell from the Office of Legislative Counsel. This is the annual tax revisers bill, and most of this bill does make changes in syntax and structure. As you just mentioned, it does make changes to the pollution control tax credit, including a repeal of the credit. We have realized since this bill was drafted that that may be in haste, that that may be premature, and while the credit is no longer available, people can no longer apply and get certified for the credit. There are people who are there is still revenue impact, and this should not be repealed in this bill. So this would need to be amended as far as the repeal of the pollution control tax credit, and then there are other statutes that provide for certification and the like, statutes that are in Chapter 468. So this would need to be repealed to make those changes. I can go through the rest of the bill, which I believe does make needed changes, but as we always strive, non-substantive changes, any change that would actually be a change in the substantive law, we would not include in the annual tax revisers bill. So starting at the beginning,
Senator Boquist has a question.
Just so I can annotate it on my, would you clarify which section is the pollution one that needs to be amended out?
Chair Hass, Senator Boquist, that is 315.304 is the credit itself, and that's in Section 10 of this bill.
Okay,
but there are other sections as well. Section 11 of the bill, Section 12, Sections 22 through 25.
That's what I thought, okay.
And then also Section 6 7, and 8. Those are conforming amendments that were changed. Those statutes were changed to account for the repeal of 315, okay. 304, and also to make other stylistic changes.
So fairly significant downsizing of paper.
Exactly.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
But no, but the goal here in all of these, every session is no policy here, just removing clutter.
Our goal is always to make this a non-substantive bill, to make changes in readability and clarity, changes in syntax, and then also there are repeals typically of tax credit provisions that are obsolete or other provisions in the tax law that are obsolete.
Okay.
So starting at the beginning of the bill, the first three sections deal with changes to syntax and vocabulary. In particular, there are three property tax sections that contain the term demolishment, which is not the correct term. The term should be demolition. A demolishment is not a term that is found in the dictionary. And in the course of making that change, we've made other changes to syntax and to accord with our form and style. So those are sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. Sections 4 and 5 have to deal with the riparian land exemption, which is a property tax statute. And section 308A380 provides for an exemption that is now obsolete. It's tied to property tax years 2004 and earlier. So the sections 4 and 5 are linked to that, and that's where you see those changes. Again, sections 6, 7, and 8 should be taken out by amendment. Those are changes, excuse me, I correct myself. Section 7 repeals 314, 705, and 314, 710. Those are provisions linked to the multi-state tax commission. And in the 2013 session, we made changes to the provisions in the Oregon Revised Statutes that adopted the multi-state tax compact. These two repeals are needed to conform to that change. So those are conforming amendments. Section 9 deals with the working family child care credit, and it makes a change to the applicability language. There's a session law provision in Section 9 that's amended to provide for applicability before January 1, 2016, rather than a repeal. Our practice is typically with tax credits, rather than repealing them, we deal with their applicability over tax years, and then if they are in fact not used and are no longer applicable, we repeal them later in the tax revisor's bill. So this was structured as a repeal, which is not our not our practice and not our form and style. So that makes that change. It doesn't change the date. To make a substantive change to this provision would require amending that date.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Buckley.
This is actually up on the tax credit side, isn't it? This particular one?
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, this would be, to make a substantive change would require a bill it wouldn't be made in the revisor's bill. This is a structural or even a stylistic change.
Right. Follow-up question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist.
My question is, if I recall correctly, is I understand what you're saying, but this is actually up on the sunset tax credit side, this particular credit up there.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I believe I have drafted bills that would make that change and would extend the sunset in the appropriate form.
Thank you.
Then in Section 13, there is a change to the definitions that are provided for the tax credit in lieu of nursing home care, and all that does is in line 43, it removes quotation marks around the term household income. That's not an appropriate use of punctuation.
That's good. That's a good fix.
This is a good fix.
English majors and journalists appreciate these kinds of things.
Thank you. In section 14, which is 316.157, that's credit for retirement income. And on page 9, in line 20, there's simply a typo where it read 316.085. It should have been 314.085. That's actually been in statute, I think, for close to 20 years and was not caught and is now being changed. So merely a typo. And in section 15, which is 316.158, that provides for severability of the statute that provides for the retirement income credit. And it actually referred to itself. This draft removes, in line 31 on page 9, removes the reference to 316.158 and replaces it with the words this section and, because it was a self-reference, if you will. In section 16, which is 316.372, it talks about obligations of minors to file tax returns. It makes some changes to syntax, and it also moves the there's a definition found in the middle of the section, which is not where we typically place definitions. Generally, we place them at the beginning of a statute or at the end, and this makes that change. Section 17 is another section that deals with a pollution control tax credit, and it would simply remove a reference to that repealed statute. So that would be removed by amendment. Section 18 makes a form and style change to provisions dealing with the distribution of cigarette tax revenues. This section was amended twice in the special session bill in the fall of 2013. It was then amended again in the 2014 session. This section provides a bridge between those two sections to show the progress of how it was amended. So this is strictly a technical change, and in fact is not going to be, this language will never be applicable because it's already been superseded by the language, the amendments that were made in the 2014 session. Section 19 amends session law, and it works in tandem with Section 18 to make those changes to the provisions for distribution of cigarette tax revenue. And then sections 20 through the end deal with the pollution control tax credit and would be repealed in an amended version of this bill. And I believe that completes it.
I'm just curious, Kate, how you get to a bill like this. Do you just compile places that you need to change during the year and you start working on this in the summer, or how?
Chair House, we keep a list of, for this and also for the main revisers bill, which deals with basically all ORS sections that are not tax law, we keep lists of different provisions that we need to address. Mm-hmm. We keep records of places where, as in this, there's a typo, there was a number that was mistyped at some point, there's an obsolete reference. Typically, there'll be a statute that's repealed in one session, and then we need to go back and make changes to statutes that refer to it and were not amended to accommodate that change. So we keep a running list of suggested changes. There are some that are arguably substantive, and we discuss those. We also discuss this with the Department of Revenue. There may be statutes that are no longer needed because of procedural changes or changes in federal law or changes in Oregon case law.
Well, it's just an ongoing pursuit. I know I went through this with one of your colleagues on the higher education law as a result of the major changes we've made in the last 4 years. It was quite a bit of cleanup to do. That's a big bill, too, that he's been working on since last summer. Any questions on Senate Bill 36? Technical changes, no policy. We need an amendment, so this will come back before us in a week or so. If there are no other questions, no one else signed up to testify, I'll close the public hearing. Thank you. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
Christine. And I will move on to Senate Bill 59 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 59. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 59 continues with the theme of technical clarifications.
And this is on the grand bargain?
This is a...
from last year?
Correct, Mr. Chair, as I try to get into the bill so I can reference the sections. It's not letting me. Okay, I'll try to go from memory. In the grand bargain in the fall of 2013, there was House Bill 3601 that I think everybody's familiar with. And part of the policy there was preferential tax rates for pass-through entities. And after that got passed and the language was circulated within the CPA community, we've been getting some input about technical clarifications that would be useful to streamline the return filing process. And in 2014, there was a bill that handled a number of such clarifications. In this bill, there are two more clarifications that deal with unique situations at the federal level. The first one is an example, and I believe it's in Section 7 of the bill. Or Section 1, Paragraph 7. And this has to do with, in federal law, the theme here is connecting Oregon law to federal law, just making that consistent between the two. And the example here, in layman's terms, is if you have a taxpayer who operates, say, three different businesses, but they are all arguably one single activity and one economic unit, at the federal level, they can choose to treat these three businesses as one business. They get to group them. And that's the language about the single activity where the taxpayer has elected to group the related businesses, business entities that formed an interrelated, integrated economic unit. And so if they've making that election at the federal level, if the language here in Senate Bill 59 were to become law, then that election would flow through to Oregon, so that if in this integrating unit, if they met the material participation requirements for the preferential tax rates, they would benefit from those. If this provision were not in Oregon law, then they would have to take this integrated unit, say, for example, the three businesses, and separate them each out and decide how much of the income from each one of these businesses was active or passive income. So this just says, for all practical purposes, it's one business, even though technically and legally they're three businesses. For tax reasons, you get to treat them as one business.
And this is different than in federal law?
Well, this part is federal law. They get, if I'm a small business owner and I have three businesses, and for one reason I've structured them as three businesses, one, maybe I have one business that's renting a building out to another one of my businesses. Okay, that's the only use of that building. And for a variety of reasons that I won't attempt to get into, you'd really want to talk to a CPA. And as a side note, the CPAs will be in the building next Tuesday, I think, for the reconnect, so that might be a good idea. We weren't able to get any CPAs here this morning.
So this is actually a reconnect issue?
That's one way to look at it. Yeah. Each of these is kind of a reconnect issue. And the second one, if that's enough of a mangling of that first concept. So it's just how it gets treated at the federal level is how it gets treated here. And so the relevance is now in Oregon law for these pass-through entities, we have this active income or this non-passive income and passive income. So I have three businesses, and say one business, it's all rental income, so that would be passive income, but I materially participate in the other two. So for the policies of the grand bargain, I would have to separate all of those out and apply the preferential rates to just two of those businesses because I meet the active requirements. And so now you're taking a federal policy where they were able to combine them. Now just for Oregon, they have to separate them out. And for tax filing purposes, that's a lot more complicated and isn't really consistent with the intent of the grand bargain. practically they're the same business, so they just get lumped together and they're treated together as one unit at the federal level, and they will continue to be treated as such in Oregon.
Passive or federal?
However it lands out.
You're right. Mungled.
Got it.
arguably, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Arguably, the idea would be for sticking with the three businesses. I'm actively involved in two of them, but one of them is arranged as a rental property, so that's passive income. But they're really all, the only thing that rental property does is rent to my other businesses.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do here is a cleanup, a taxpayer-friendly cleanup. Very oversimplistic way to look at this.
Yes.
Senator Bushier.
Well, on the federal tax returns, the difference between the rental and the ordinary income is the Social Security taxes. Okay, that's where the big difference is with there. So we don't have that at the state level. Yeah, it is. It's quite interesting.
That's for one of the reasons why these three businesses
right.
would be treated as one. Now, they have to be very interrelated. They can't be three completely different businesses that have nothing to do with each other. It's just for other reasons, largely tax-driven, they get legally structured as three different businesses. But from an economic standpoint, a practical standpoint, they could easily all be just in one business. And so the IRC in 469 says, well, if that's the case, then you can go ahead and treat them as one business for tax purposes. And this has never been an issue in Oregon law before because we never had the preferential rates for the pass-through entities. But now that we have that in law, this would be taxpayer-friendly. It would save them some CPA fees by just saying, okay, well, this is what it is at the federal level, so that's what it is in Oregon.
What does that do to minimum taxes?
Senator Riley, minimum taxes as in the corporate minimum?
Mm-hmm.
These are pass-through entities.
So they don't have the corporate minimum.
Right, they don't have that corporate, the
Thank you.
C-corporate minimum.
Senator Boakley?
Just to be friendly to Senator Riley. The minimum filing fees and so on and so forth, they'd still file as three over in the Secretary of State side.
Yeah, that wasn't
for,
what yeah,
I know, but I'm just trying, I'm looking for the fees at the bottom, right? So it doesn't give them the ability to say, no, we're one.
Yeah,
I got it.
Right, for those filing, and that's almost precisely the point, is the Secretary of State, they would be three businesses, mm-hmm. but for purposes of the income tax, they get to treat them as one.
Yeah.
All right. One more question.
Sure.
So we're basically talking about sole proprietor LLCs or S-corps, it would be the mixture of the three, correct?
We're talking about LLCs, primarily S-corporations and partnerships, and the LLCs who choose to file as an S-corporation or partnership. We're not talking about sole proprietors.
They're not part of this law.
And we're not talking about C-corps.
And we're not talking about C-corps, correct.
Okay.
And the second piece in paragraph 7 does kind of get to a Schedule C situation where there are these things called qualified joint ventures. And if you have a business where the husband and they're joint filers, it's a husband and wife situation, and they are the only members of this business, at the federal level, they can choose not to file as a partnership. So my understanding right now is that they're filing as two Schedule Cs. So they've made the election to not file as a partnership. And this language would just maintain that treatment for Oregon again. Almost kind of in the reverse situation where they've chosen not to file as a partnership, because otherwise I think the possibility is that they could file as two different structures at federal and Oregon, and then that's largely what the policy is intended, what you want to avoid. So, whatever you are at the federal level is what you are at the Oregon level, a taxpayer simplification kind of thing, to just make sure all that treatment is the same.
Okay. Senator Bertrand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still struggling with the three businesses at the federal level, because you're dealing with three. Are we dealing with three federal tax ID numbers then, or is there one tax ID number for all three businesses?
At the risk of stepping into CPA territory, and this is my current understanding, and I would suggest, and we'll try to get to some CPAs, because these really are CPA questions. But my understanding right now is that legally they would be three different ID numbers. So there's structurally three businesses, and that happens for a variety of other reasons within the tax code. But for purposes of the income tax, they're effectively one business, so they can be treated as one because of how closely they are related. Like the business rental property, the only place it rents to is one of my other businesses. So you couldn't do this if I have two, three, or four businesses that have nothing to do with each other. So I have a business that I want, and I could set it up as a single business, or I talk to my CPA, and they say, you know, if you kind of parse out these activities, you can create two or three businesses, and there's some advantages to that.
Senator Edwards.
So this would apply to businesses that they could be materially related to one another, but not exclusively related to one another. Like you could have a sales company that not only handles the sales for your widget factory, but also handles sales from other people's widget factories.
Senator Edwards, I don't see why not.
Okay.
I mean, the language gets down to almost like making a case and arguing that, well, these three businesses are a single economic unit. But I don't see anything that prohibits them from dealing with other businesses, if I follow your question.
Right. That's what, yeah, that's
at what point
what
do you delineate the difference between similar companies and, as you just said, if they're not similar, I mean, are we splitting hairs?
I think you can get into a case where a CPA might be making an argument with the IRS. Okay. And depending on where that would land, and it might be a case by case. But all the more reason to just tie with, okay, well, whatever is set up at the federal level, it gets done here. So there isn't.
Let them make that call. Is that, let's not get into it.
Right. And from the CPAs I've talked to, that's really the theme. It saves that situation. So, because right now, to take advantage of the lower rates for the pass through entities, under Oregon law, they'd have to take each of these and figure out, okay, do you materially participate in business A and materially participate in business B and materially participate in business C, even though they're arguably, on the face of it, all the same business.
I guess I'm just struggling with the creativity.
Senator Boquist?
Well, to just go back to Senator Bertschiger's deal, as oddly as this seems, you know, I don't speak IRS, CPA, or Greek speak, but you can literally take, you know, have three separate companies that file practice of your purpose and file under one, even though they have separate ID numbers, and file under one tax company, or one under one tax ID number. Now, how that works, because I do that, I have no idea, because it's like the IRS says, yes, you do that, and then the CPA says, yes, you do that, and I sign the form, but I have no idea why the hell they do it, okay? But it can be done, so I understand the concept. Not why. And it's the federal government, so therefore, they're not going to tell us why.
Okay, so I guess the question, Chair, is this going to work, this bill? I guess that is the question.
Senator Bertschiger, this, just a little background. So the Grand Bargain, that special session was in October of 2013. And I believe in the December, at the December revenue forecast to the revenue committees, a couple CPAs, members of the US CPA, came and presented to the committees, you know, at their first blush. And they had it was a two-pager, and there were a half a dozen things that they had gone through. Okay, well, now that this is law, here are a few things that we see that would just streamline it. You know, arguably no policy change. It was just, well, this would make it cleaner and easier and save taxpayers money or save them CPA costs. Most of those got put into, I believe it was Senate Bill 1534 in the 2014 session. These are just two pieces that were part of that original document in December of 2014. As far as I know, these are not controversial, but after today we'll find out.
Okay.
That controversial
likely to not have a fiscal or revenue impact, although we don't have those statements yet.
As I look at these right now, they would not, the bill as drafted would not have a revenue impact.
Senator Boquist?
Just clarification, but I guess the CPAs are coming for their annual what they like, don't like meeting next week with us, right? And this will be on their list, I'm assuming, Mr. Chair.
I think so. If not, we can certainly ask them about it. But since it came from CPAs and has the magical phrase "streamline" in it, I think it's probably a good bet to move forward.
Is that the government definition of streamline or the private sector definition of streamline?
Okay, so with no further questions on that and no one signed up to testify, I will then close the public hearing on...
There is an amendment.
There will be an amendment on this. Do you have it now?
There's an amendment in OLIS.
The dash ones.
The dash one. This one adds some members may recall this one. This adds the words "from Oregon sources," and this one was controversial in 2014.
Yes, okay. Paul was telling me about
that. Okay. So that is just out in OLIS.
And this was controversial because?
I believe some people felt it might be a tax increase or perhaps was inconsistent with some of the premises of the grand bargain. And you get into some discussions where the idea, I believe, that the preferential rates were, the idea behind them was to help create jobs in Oregon so that the business income subject to the lower rates would be from business income from Oregon sources. And the language right now doesn't specifically say from Oregon sources, so you could have an Oregon taxpayer who has a S-Corp or a partnership in another state and the income is from the other state and they would benefit from those lower rates because they're a full year resident here, so they'd be paying tax on that income.
All right. The bill is a committee bill from the interim.
Right.
The amendment is from where?
It was also just from the leftover before, but it was controversial, so it got drafted as an amendment as opposed to the main bill.
All right. I remember that. I don't think it was hugely controversial, but maybe the grand bargainer here from Polk County could refresh my memory. But adding it at this stage doesn't seem controversial since the cake is baked.
Or half baked, yeah. I mean,
no, that's us.
Right, I know. Yeah. That's what I mean. But it's LRO proposing the amendment for clarification.
It's on our list of things. Okay. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't see that it's controversial at the moment. Need a fiscal, need all that stuff, put it in the bill. You want to put it in the bill right now and then argue about it and then see what the CPA said in the future. I don't care what you're doing.
We'll just leave it until afterwards.
I mean, the whole point is to make Oregon. This is supposed to do something in Oregon, so I mean, I don't remember enough of the controversy that it makes it controversial today. So, and I was in the room. But.
Okay. So that's the amendment. There may be more, but for now it's still in the category of technical cleanup bill designed to help taxpayers and streamline what we did in the grand bargain. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, if that's all we have and no one signed up to testify, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 59 and we'll take a swing at it probably later next week and hopefully have the revenue and fiscal statements too. And that clears our business today. We are working with drafters, just so you know, on central assessment, and hope to have another look at that, including studying the revenue impact on Thursday, and with an outside possibility of putting both of those data center and global fix into one bill to look at very seriously, passing early next week. So that's where we are with that issue, and once we get that out of here, we can sort of resume the normal revenue committee structure and go through the other issues that are before us, including looking at stable funding measures. So, with no other business before us, Paul, we are adjourned. We are adjourned.